This is The Guardian.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to you? For me, it was seeing a cloaked figure at the end of my bed. For you, it might have been a ghost floating down the hall of an old, stately manor, or discovering a book you lost long ago in a charity shop while on holiday. While some odd experiences are easier to explain, sleep paralysis, a trick of the light, or an amazing coincidence, others can be trickier to make sense of. And for some, the only reasonable explanation is the paranormal.
Like a lot of teenagers, I was fascinated with the paranormal, and I still am, except I'm no longer a believer in the paranormal.
Chris French has been interested in strange goings-on for a long time.
When I was an undergraduate student in the final year, on a Friday night, we'd come back from the pub and we'd get the Ouija board out. But we were doing it by then just purely for entertainment purposes. We didn't take it seriously at all.
Eventually, he did take it seriously, or at least he took trying to understand the psychology behind this stuff seriously. For decades, he's been studying, well, weird shit.
I remember being asked to kind of do some testing of a guy who claimed that he was Magnet Man, basically. It turns out that the explanation is the same as it always is, that if you have very smooth skin and you're a little bit sweaty, things will stick to you, you know?
He's recently written a book exploring the topics that have dominated his career. So today, I'm speaking to Chris about why so many of us end up believing in the paranormal, where our cognitive biases trip us up, and how this all links to conspiracy theories. From The Guardian, I'm Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly. Chris French, you're former head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit at Goldsmiths, University of London, and your new book is called The Science of Weird Shit. So perhaps you can explain exactly what anomalistic psychology is and how it investigates, well, weird shit.
Anomalistic psychology is primarily focused upon trying to come up with non-paranormal explanations for ostensibly paranormal experiences. Its working hypothesis is, let's just assume that paranormal forces don't exist. Can we explain the kind of weird experiences that people definitely do have without resorting to paranormal explanations? And so typically we're interested in things like the unreliability of memory, hallucinatory experiences, and various cognitive biases that might affect the way that we perceive what's going on around us.
In your book, many of the experiences you describe that lead people to believe in, you know, things like ghosts and fairies, reincarnation, and whatnot, they share this feature that people find it difficult to find more rational explanations for them. Someone thinks that the curtains have opened or the floor creaked by itself, or there's a very real feeling figure at the end of the bed, or, you know, like we were saying, a dream comes true. Why do people end up turning towards the more sort of fantastical end of the spectrum when they're looking for an explanation?
I mean, there's all sorts of factors come into play. One of them is obviously, what are the kind of prior beliefs that we're bringing to the situation? If you've been brought up in a religious household, then you probably already believe in life after death. I think you can make a very strong case that our brains have evolved in such a way that we do have certain cognitive biases that make us predisposed towards those kinds of explanations. I mean, I'll give you just one example. There's something called the intentionality bias, sometimes referred to as agenticity, the idea that when something happens in the world around us, it happens because someone or something made it happen with particular intentions towards us. Now, if you think about this in terms of our evolutionary past, it's all about threat detection. So we tend to err on the side of making the mistake of thinking that something is there, something did happen, rather than the opposite mistake of missing something that might actually be a potential threat, because that way you stay alive long enough to pass on your genes to the next generation.
You write in the book about the role of probabilities and how generally our natural disposition is to be pretty bad at stats, and how that can kind of lead us astray and to think that improbable events are sort of totally impossible. So let's start with coincidences, actually. I mean, you give some great examples in the book. Have you got a favourite coincidence, and why do you think we enjoy these so much?
I think there's a very good reason why we enjoy it, which I'll come to. I'll just give you one example. A kind of recent one that happened to my sister-in-law, Jane Hatzimasouris, who had gone back to Greece, used to live there, but she'd gone back for a holiday. She was in a cafe near the coast with some friends. One of them had gone out for a swim in the sea, and he'd found a ring about 40 yards out. He brought it back, and obviously they were all kind of chatting about this, and Jane couldn't help but notice that there was a woman in the cafe who wasn't part of their group who was listening intently in on the conversation, and the woman eventually approached. Now, I should explain that in Greece, it's tradition that when you get married, the groom has the bride's name and the date of the wedding engraved on the ring, and vice versa. And this ring did indeed have a name and a date on it. And the woman came up and basically said, "I'm really sorry to interrupt, but I couldn't help but overhear what you were saying. And the thing is, you know, the name on the ring, that's my surname, and my dad lost his wedding ring about 40 years ago while swimming out in the sea." She then called her mother to just check on the date. And the mother said, no, it wasn't that date. The date we got married was a few months after that. But then she phoned her dad, and he explained that he hadn't had the date of the wedding engraved on the ring. He'd had the date of the engagement. And it was indeed the ring that he had lost all those years before. You know, the chances of that woman being in the right place at the right time to overhear that conversation are astronomically low, but it happened.
So how should we think about a coincidence which feels as unlikely as that one?
I mean, some people would listen to that and think, wow, what an amazing coincidence, which it quite undeniably is. Other people might kind of want to invoke other forces, like, oh, it was fate, or, you know, people might go for a psychic, a paranormal explanation. Now, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, I think we all find a coincidence is amazing. But I think there's a really good reason. I mean, rather than thinking of that tendency to be fascinated by coincidences as anything irrational, it's actually very rational, because it might not be just a coincidence. There might be some real connection there. But if you look at the kind of mathematics of coincidence and the psychology of coincidence, you realize that these amazing coincidences will be happening every single day.
You also talk in the book about these things called population stereotypes and believers in ESP, so what, extrasensory perception. Can you do this experiment with our listeners to demonstrate that?
I can have a go, but of course the problem is we won't be able to get the results. But if we could, I'm pretty sure I'd know what.
Or will
be.
We?
This is something that I kind of often include in when I'm doing kind of talks, and I'll start the presentation by saying that I'm going to do a little test with my audience to see how psychic they are. And so I'll now do a test with the listeners to the podcast. I'm going to see if I can transmit a message from my mind into your minds. I'm going to keep it very, very simple. It's a number between 1 and 10, not 3, because that's too obvious. And I'm going to transmit the number to you now. So make a mental note of whatever number came into your head then. Now, obviously, I'm sure this podcast has thousands, if not millions of listeners. So some of them will get it right just by chance. So we only get ecstatically excited if it's more than about 10% of them. Now, how many people out there thought of the number 7? Now, when you do this with a crowd right in front of you and you see the sea of hands go up, you will typically get about a third of your audience. You'll get well over 10%. And this is one very simple demonstration of this thing called population stereotypes. We feel as if we're making a free choice out of the options available. And therefore, our intuition tells us that the response frequencies across each of those different options ought to be about the same. But it just doesn't work like that. People's responses cluster. And in this case, I mean, you already, by the way you introduce it, you rule out the number 3, otherwise you'd get another little peek there as well. So by ruling that out, you will get about a third of your audience going for the number 7. I mean, I very often then follow it up where I say, okay, you know, this, I'm going to do a 2-digit number this time. It's between 1 and 50. It's 2 odd digits and they're not the same. So you could have 15, 1 and 5, both odd digits, not the same. You couldn't have 11. Both odd digits, but they are the same. So the first number that fits that description that comes into your head now. And then you say, okay, did anybody think of 37? And again, about you get about a third of the audience. And you can follow that up with, did anybody think of 35? Because, sorry, I thought of 35 first, then I changed my mind. I confused you there. You know, you'll get another quarter of the audience there. So these are very, very reliable demonstrations. Now, of course, they're nothing to do with ESP. It doesn't matter what I'm thinking of. And there are, as I say, various other examples as well. But they can be passed off as such. And indeed, some of the world's most famous self-proclaimed psychics have done so.
Do we know why those biases exist, though? Where they actually come from?
No.
Why do people go for a 7 or a 37?
We can only kind of speculate, really. I mean, one possibility with the number 7, for example, is that maybe it's the kind of mystical connotations of that number that attract people. I think it feels like a really random choice. People don't like to go for the first and the last number in the sequence. 5's right in the middle, so that's obviously not random. Whereas 7, ooh, that kind of feels random. I mean, in the 37 example, people don't realise that there's only 8 numbers that fit the description in the first place, and you rule one of those out by mentioning it. People don't go for 15 because you've mentioned it. But to be honest, nobody really knows why those kind of clustering effects take place.
This difficulty in getting our heads around probabilities, I mean, it's not only common, it's probably the default, right, for the population. But I mean, have any of these cognitive biases been sort of passed off or linked to belief in the paranormal then?
I mean, the thing to emphasize is we all have these cognitive biases. The question really then is, well, first of all, are some of them relevant to why we might actually misinterpret certain situations as having to have paranormal explanations when maybe there are other more plausible explanations? And the second issue is, do believers tend to show these biases more than non-believers in the paranormal? And I think the response to the first question is yes, definitely. There's a whole list of cognitive biases that we could reel off that do have relevance. We are very, very good. One of the reasons we're so successful as a species at picking up on meaningful patterns in what's going on around us. But we overplay it, you know, and we sometimes think we've seen a meaningful pattern. We're joining the dots when really they shouldn't be joined. There is evidence to suggest that believers are more prone to that kind of thing than non-believers. I mean, one example of this is what's something called the repetition avoidance bias. If you ask people to generate random digits, then they tend to avoid repeating. And of course, randomness means that if you're doing the digits from 0 to 9, it's a 10% chance that you might repeat. And sometimes you'll even repeat 2 or 3 or 4. But that doesn't correspond to our intuitive idea of randomness, which is something that's a kind of more vague kind of ooh, all jumbled up kind of notion, you know. And believers in the paranormal show this repetition avoidance bias more than skeptics. Skeptics show it, but they don't show it quite as strongly.
A lot of what we've been talking about, Chris, feels like it has parallels to misinformation. And I wondered if you think there are crossovers between people who have these paranormal beliefs and people who end up believing in, say, conspiracy theories?
Absolutely. No, I mean, this is another area that we have done quite a lot of research in. I'll give a plug to my postgrad, Rob Brotherton, who wrote an excellent book on conspiracy, believing conspiracy theories called Suspicious Minds. But yeah, a lot of the same biases found in terms of paranormal beliefs and conspiracy beliefs. I mean, again, to give one example, one of the studies that Robin carried out under my supervision was looking at the intentionality bias that I mentioned earlier, the idea that when things happen, someone or something made them happen. Well, obviously, that maps onto conspiracy type thinking very, very clearly. For most conspiracy theorists, nothing happens by accident. There's always somebody pulling the strings behind. There's always somebody in control, to this hyper level of control, which doesn't really seem to correspond to anything that I've ever seen in world leaders. But there you go, you know. They kind of always go for the conspiracy explanation rather than the cock-up explanation.
You know, when you know, your position is as a skeptic, people who believe in conspiracy theories also consider themselves skeptics. That's what they say. They say they're skeptical. So where do you draw this line between being questioning and critical of stuff and just going down the rabbit hole of denying everything around you?
Well, I've often described conspiracy theorists as skeptics without the critical thinking skills, because it's good to question. You know, I don't want people to stop questioning, and particularly, you know, pronouncements coming from on high, from the governments and various other sources of authority. Yes, we should question, but you then, I think, need to kind of step back and be able to evaluate the evidence. I'm not saying that's necessarily always easy to do. I mean, the thing about conspiracy theories and belief in conspiracy theories is that they are a perfect example of what a friend of mine, Stephen Law, a philosopher, calls intellectual black holes. It's a kind of belief system that once you're inside it, it's incredibly difficult to get out, because any evidence that seems to count against the conspiracy, well, that was just put there by the conspirators, wasn't it? These people are very powerful. It's kind of confirmation bias that we all suffer from, but it's confirmation bias with very big boots on, you know. And there's nothing that could convince a hardcore conspiracy theorist that they might be wrong. Now, an important part of skepticism, an important part of science, is always to be able to say, what's the evidence that would prove your hypothesis wrong? You should be willing to change your mind if new evidence comes along.
Finally, Chris, you spent a lot of your time, I think you still do, debating believers of all kinds. Do you think you ever change anyone's mind?
Probably not. Well, again, not in terms of the people I'm debating with. In the same way that I'm emotionally invested in the skeptics being right. You know, I mean, I'm not one of these people who say I don't have any biases. We all do. Anybody who thinks that they are a neutral assessor of the evidence, that's very naive. So I bring my kind of current preconceptions as an ex-believer. I used to believe in a lot of this stuff, and I no longer do. So you can change your mind. But when I'm dealing with these kind of situations, somebody who is really, really invested in the opposite point of view and has maybe spent a lot of time reading around what they see as being the best evidence and how to rebut the skeptics' arguments, I'm never going to convince them. But people in the audience who are maybe undecided, then, you know, I've probably got a chance with them.
Has there ever been, though, anything that you've felt almost persuaded by that's made you look at your sort of skeptic stance and you think, actually, have I got this right?
Most of the time, there's nothing that really shakes my skepticism at all. But I do have a kind of little mental box with a question mark on it for the one or two times when I thought, well, OK, I'm still a skeptic, but that was quite interesting. One example would be a documentary I took part in called The Man Who Paints the Future. And this was an old chap. He was an artist and he claimed that his dreams foretold future events. I mean, just to give you an example, he painted two pictures of the Twin Towers collapsing. Now, one was a couple of months before it happened. The other was 5 years before it happened. But it was 5 years to the day. So, yeah, you're kind of, ooh, that's quite interesting. At the end of the day, I've been a skeptic now for a long time. Maybe I'll come back in 10 years' time and we'll do another interview and I'll have changed my mind because some dramatic new evidence will come along. But I'm not holding my breath.
Chris, huge thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Chris French. His book is The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Madeline Finley. It was sound designed by Tony Onochuku. And the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.